B English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran begins a major military exercise in the Persian Gulf region as it's warning against any attack on its military and nuclear sites. China blames what it calls strategic misjudgments by the U.S. for the problems in relations between the two countries. Celebrations erupting in Chilean cities following the victory of leftist candidate Gabriel Boric in the presidential runoff. This is World News. I'm Behrouz, and as you live broadcast from Tehran. Welcome. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has launched large-scale military drills south of the country, involving a variety of units. The maneuvers are codenamed the Great Prophet 17. They're held in the Persian Gulf and the Strait of Hormuz regions, as well as the coasts of Hormuzgan, Bushehr, and Khuzestan provinces. The IRGC Deputy Commander for Operations says that the Ground, Navy, and Aerospace Divisions, as well as some popular forces, are participating in the drills. Abbas Nilforjan says that the theme of the drills is might, security, and active deterrence under the auspices of national unity, solidarity, and unanimity. He says that the objective of the drills is to increase the combat readiness of IRGC forces by using the most advanced equipment and tactics to counter enemy threats and combined arms warfare. Top Iranian military commander is warning that the Islamic Republic will give a crushing response to any attack on its military and nuclear sites. The commander of the Khatam al-Anbiya Central Headquarters has warned Iran will not hesitate in its response. Major General Ghulam Ali Rashid says Tehran will target the source of aggression, the bases, the territory, and the airspace used for any such attack. He noted that any Israeli threat against the Iranian sites would be impossible without the U.S. support. Back in September, the Israeli Minister of Military Affairs said that the regime is preparing a strike on Iran. American and other Israeli officials have made similar suggestions over the past months. Meantime, Iran has confirmed air defense systems fired near its nuclear power plant in the southern city of Bushehr. It said it was part of military drills in that area. Deputy Governor of Bushehr Province for Security Affairs said that the exercises were held at 5 a.m. local time in the southern parts of the province and in the Persian Gulf area. Mohammad Taghi Rani says that the drills were held in full coordination with the armed forces. Iran already conducted similar exercises over its nuclear facility in the central city of Natanz on November 28th. Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman has held his weekly presser with the negotiations between Iran and the P4+1 in Vienna, being the focal point of that event. We asked whether the ministry could provide a clear image about the talks there.
The image we have from the JCPOA is a contradictory one. Some people say they are optimistic and there's been progress in talks, but at the same time, some Europeans say there is only a few weeks left, and they're giving an ultimatum to Iran, and they're worried about Iran's nuclear advances. They say the JCPOA has turned into an empty shell. Can you give us a clear image about the talks and the future of negotiations in Vienna, please? Thank you.
Well, basically, the two sides have to avoid warning comments. The words that are alarming do not have depth. I have already clearly announced, and now once again announced, that the Troika has to know that the JCPOA became void for Iran at a time when the U.S. withdrew from the deal and imposed unilateral sanctions against the Iranian nation, and the three European countries moved in line with the U.S. by not taking any action. I urge the other side to focus on negotiations in Vienna. Iran is neither optimistic nor pessimistic. Tehran is optimistic about the principle of negotiations, and the other side has to be optimistic about the principle of talks, too.
Khatibzadeh says Tehran is realistic about the path it's taking, and that's why it's taken measures to remove U.S. sanctions in the course of the talks. The spokesman noted Iran and the remaining signatories to the deal have come up with two new draft documents that are the results of intense negotiations. He said the documents are the basis of future negotiations. Khatibzadeh added that draft documents could have been agreed upon much sooner if the other side had followed the same approach it did during the last days of the talks in Vienna. A wave of settler violence spread across the occupied West Bank in the early hours of Friday, severely injuring several Palestinians and causing damage to their property. That resulted in new calls for the international community to pressure the occupying Israeli regime into stopping extremist settlers from committing acts of violence against Palestinians and their communities. Here's a closer look.
Scores of Palestinians have been injured by Israeli settlers in villages around the city of Nablus in the occupied West Bank following a shooting near an illegal outpost in Homesh that left one settler dead and two wounded. Dozens of Israeli settlers attacked Qaryut village south of Nablus overnight. The attackers broke into many homes in the town and assaulted local families. Scores of Palestinians were injured in the process and moved to several hospitals in Nablus. According to the Palestinian media, the settlers also blocked the main highway connecting Nablus and Ramallah and attacked vehicles with Palestinian license plates with the stones, causing damages to several cars. In reaction to the attacks, the Palestinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Expatriates called on the United Nations to promptly activate the international protection system for Palestinian civilians under Israeli occupation. It also called on the international community to pressure the Israeli regime into stopping acts of terrorism committed by settlers against Palestinians and their communities. The ministry held the regime of Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett fully and directly responsible for settler violence and terror, and warned against the dangerous repercussions of their acts on the status of the region. It is stressed that Israeli authorities are encouraging and protecting settler violence, which is soaring on a daily basis. According to Israeli advocacy group B'Tselem, 2021 saw a rise in settler violence of 28.6% compared to last year. UN human rights experts have expressed alarm at the rising rate of violence directed by Israeli settlers toward Palestinians in the occupied Palestinian territory. According to the United Nations Office for the Coordination of the Humanitarian Affairs, already in the first 10 months of 2021, there have been 410 attacks by settlers against Palestinians. Four Palestinians were killed by settlers this year. Nearly 700,000 Israelis live in over 230 settlements built since the 1967 occupation of the Palestinian territories of the West Bank. All the settlements are illegal under international law, and the United Nations Security Council has condemned the settlement activities in several resolutions. Since occupying the West Bank, Israel has misappropriated more than 200,000 hectares of land there for its own purposes, including building and expanding settlements and paving roads for settlers. Some areas have been taken over by the regime, issuing military orders, others through daily acts of settler violence. These two seemingly unrelated tracks are both forms of state violence. The Israeli apartheid regime and its representatives actively aid and abet the settlers' violence as part of his strategy to cement the takeover of Palestinian land.
The settlers and the uniformed soldiers work together, not without tensions, but they always support each other, and the settlers are used to carry out the particular kinds of attacks, burning trees, certain kinds of terror attacks, which the army prefers not to do. They shoot, they kill, but they protect the settlers 100% of the time. The settlers know this, and it gives them a sense of complete impunity.
Now, despite what Palestinians, Israeli security officials, and rights groups have confirmed as a clear rise in settler attacks on Palestinians, Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett recently said otherwise, calling settler violence a marginal issue. Now, some believe that's a deliberate attempt to legitimize settler violence against Palestinians.
Last week, the U.S. Undersecretary of State Victoria Nuland and an Israeli minister who is responsible for police discussed the increase in settler violence against Palestinians. That drew rebukes from pro-settlement ministers and right-wing opposition lawmakers within the Israeli regime. Omer Bar-Lev later pushed back his critics, saying they were having difficulty looking in the mirror and that settler violence has become an issue on the international stage. But Israel's Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett, jumped in to say it's just a marginal issue. In a tweet on Tuesday, he noted that there are marginal elements in every community, and they should be dealt with using all means. But we must not generalize about an entire community. The Combatants for Peace group, which brings together Israeli and Palestinian victims of violence, condemned Bennett for his Tuesday comments, charging that the Prime Minister had given full backing to depraved settler violence, which has reached new heights under his watch. The group added that Bennett gave a green light to the Wild West atmosphere in the territories. Also, an interview published on Wednesday revealed what Israeli Foreign Minister thinks about this issue. He told an American periodical earlier this month that extremist violence is a stain on Israel amid a noted rise in violent attacks by Israeli settlers against Palestinians.
There is a situation in the West Bank which is lawless. You might consider the situation to be one of no legal protection for Palestinians whatsoever.
Bennett's marginalization of the issue was aimed at legitimizing and praising settler violence, which is soaring on a daily basis. Let's not forget that Israeli soldiers and police usually defend the attackers or simply stand to the side when they assault Palestinians. Therefore, settler violence is a central issue that requires urgent attention from the international community to put an end to it.
The Chinese foreign minister has blamed strategic U.S. misjudgments for the problems in bilateral ties. Wang Yi says that China does not fear confrontation with the U.S., but it would welcome cooperation if it was mutually beneficial. He says competition between the United States and China should be positive. Beijing and Washington are at loggerheads over a host of issues. They include trade, technology, Taiwan, Hong Kong, COVID origins, and the South China Sea. In the latest flare-up, the U.S. announced it would stage diplomatic boycott of Winter Olympics in Beijing. China shrugged the move off and promised a response. A virtual summit between U.S. President Biden and his Chinese counterpart in November produced no breakthrough. International and independent China strategist Andrew K.P. Leung says Washington's maximum confrontation with Beijing is likely to continue given the deep-seated bias against China in the U.S.
The reality is that there's so much misunderstanding and this ingrained into the American politics and also in the psyche of the American electorate that China is a threat, China is a demon, that this kind of maximum pressure, maximum confrontation is likely to continue. But hopefully the United States would discover to its cost that all this kind of maximum pressure doesn't work. And there could be areas of cooperation. Of course, the areas could be very, very large and could be expanded. Mutual trust is built. First of all, of course, is on climate change, on the use of green energies, the export of American technologies, for example, on electric cars. After all, the electric car market in China is the biggest in the world. And also using American technology to help China extract its shale gas reserve, which is the largest in the world, but is geologically challenged, much more difficult terrain. And of course, even in the South China Sea, in open waters, away from the territorial claims, there are areas where both countries can organize joint patrols. And if both the Chinese Navy and the American Navy can jointly patrol open waters away from territorial disputed areas, this would send a very signal of peace and cooperation to the region.
Sure.
And there are others, one can go on. But I think the first important thing is to build mutual trust.
Now in Chile, people have taken to the streets in the capital Santiago to celebrate the victory of leftist candidate Gabriel Boric in the presidential runoff. Streets in other cities also erupted in celebration. Bora garnered 56% of the votes, with almost 99% of the ballots counted. His rival, far-right José Antonio Kast, secured 44%. Several Latin American presidents have sent congratulatory messages to him. Boric will take office for a four-year term. Starting from March next year, the new president will be dealing with some of the big challenges Chile is facing, including high inflation, the COVID pandemic, and social unrest. He'll also be in power for the approval of a new constitution that's in the process of drafting. Several American cities are witnessing a record number of homicides this year, that according to a study conducted by Agence France-Presse. Philadelphia has the highest record, with at least 535 homicides and a population of 1.5 million. The federal capital, Washington, has witnessed more than 200 homicides, while smaller cities like Albuquerque, Portland, and Oregon have also set records. According to the study, a convergence of factors is to blame. The reverberations of the coronavirus and the varied traumas it triggered, as well as the record profusion of guns in the states, are among the reasons. Gun sales set a record in 2020 with nearly 23 million firearms sold. Infections and deaths from the Omicron variant of coronavirus are increasing across the world, the UK reporting 12 related fatalities. British Deputy Prime Minister Dominic Raab says more than 100 people are also hospitalized with Omicron infection. The UK says the new variant accounts for the majority of its active COVID cases. Other European countries are also witnessing a surge in the number of Omicron infections. The variant has been detected in nearly 90 countries. The World Health Organization says that Omicron is likely to replace the Delta variant in areas with community transmissions. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Besides defending geographical borders, martyrs defend religious, spiritual, and cultural borders.
This is part of the speech delivered on November 21st, 2021, by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the officials in charge of conducting the Martyrs of Elam commemoration ceremony.
فشار دشمن و فشار جنگ نتوانسته از بروز استعدادهای این مردم چیزی کم کنه. خیلی مهمه.
The pressures brought by the enemy and the war could not stop the people of this province from showing their talents. This is very important. People like the dear martyr, Martyr Rezai Nejad, have a high spiritual status as well as a scientific status. The reason for their high spiritual status is the fact that they were martyred. Because martyrdom is not achieved easily. Martyrdom and obtaining this rank requires the existence of certain prerequisites in the nature and actions of individuals. Without these prerequisites, martyrdom is not granted to anyone. That young scientist possessed that high spiritual status, and that was why he was martyred. Otherwise, one will not become a martyr without these qualities.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
یک نکته مهم این است که خب گفته میشه که 3000 اندی شهید استان ایلام تقدیم کرده و استانهای دیگه هم هر کدوم به فراخور جمعیت و وضعیت خودشون شهدای زیادی رو تقدیم کردند. مفهوم شهادت رو بایستی ما درست درک کنیم.
An important point is that the province of Ilam has given over 3000 martyrs. Other provinces too have each given many martyrs in proportion with their population and their situation. We should understand the concept of martyrdom correctly, because martyrdom does not mean merely being a victim of the war. Well, there are many people who participate in wars and who are killed in their country's wars. Many of them are killed in defending the geographical borders of their country and remembered as patriots and heroes. Of course, some are mercenaries, but the rest are remembered, as I've said. However, our martyrs are not like this. Those of our soldiers who were martyred or disabled were not just trying to defend the geographical borders of the country. They were also struggling to defend the borders of belief, morality, religion, culture, and the spiritual borders. Of course, defending the borders of the country is a valuable act in and of itself. This has value, but it is not as important as both fighting for those important concepts and defending the borders of the country. Our martyrs are like this. If we want to look at this at a higher level, our martyrs are, in fact, the manifestation of this verse. Indeed, Allah has bought from the faithful their souls and their possessions for paradise to be theirs. The Holy Quran, Surah 9, verse 111.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities, and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will explore and explain its geopolitics, untangle the arguments from different perspectives, and make the alternative voices heard. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss how Pakistan's economic woes are prompting it to look for short-term solutions and why IMF programs are raising eyebrows. And we shall take a look at how the protracted U.S. war in Afghanistan harmed children and why their plight has no end.
With rising inflation and weakening currency taking a heavy toll on people's lives in Pakistan, Prime Minister Imran Khan's beleaguered government finds itself under tremendous pressure to look for short-term solutions. The South Asian country of 220 million has had a long history with the International Monetary Fund, with 22 programs in 70 years. Despite these programs failing to touch deeper structural issues in Pakistan, the country, reeling from a historic economic slump, has again turned to the controversial lender for help, thus raising eyebrows.
Pakistan, a member of the International Monetary Fund since 1950, has been in the global financial lenders' programs repeatedly owing to its volatile economic health. In May 2019, the Imran Khan government reached a $6 billion 39-month loan agreement with the IMF to bail out the country's impoverished, debt-ridden economy. It required the Pakistani government to commit to structural reforms and reducing public debt, which experts fear could curb growth and increase inflation. On November 22, after more than 2 years of jockeying over reform commitments, the IMF agreed to revive the stalled program. But it demanded more budgetary tightening before approving the next tranche of some $1 billion, bringing total disbursement to about $3 billion so far. On December 3, Pakistan said it was ending exemptions on sales tax to appease the international lending body. Opposition parties in Pakistan claim that the agreement will hurt the poor and downtrodden. The 2021-22 budget, they argue, is laden with tax measures proposed by the IMF that are essentially anti-poor and designed to increase inflation. The agreement will force the Imran Khan government to tighten its purse strings, which means no cash handouts or subsidized grains to the country's poor.
Pakistan is in the throes of a deep economic crisis. The South Asian country requires gross external financing of $51.6 billion within a two-year period to revive its impoverished economy. While the Imran Khan government has applied for a hefty bailout package from the IMF, the debate over whether to go or not to go to the international lending body has become intense in economic circles of the country. Experts say dependence on the IMF should not be a long-term strategy.
Pakistan Institute of Development Economics, a government-affiliated public policy think tank, has proposed well-researched policy prescriptions that could end the country's dependence on the International Monetary Fund. In a report published on December 10, it says dumbing the international lender could be a long-term plan if the government makes prudent policy and shows the ability to implement it. The prestigious policy think tank rues the fact that Islamabad has time and again approached the IMF with bailout requests, while no effort has been made to deal with the country's own long-term policy and structural deficiencies. It says the time for the government to reevaluate its approach to policy decisions has come, which until now has remained whimsical. The report cites the example of Malaysia's former Prime Minister, Mahathir Mohamad, who refused to go to the IMF. He did all that was required to put Malaysia's back on track without bailouts. Many also believe that going to the IMF will make Islamabad subservient to the US, which is the largest contributor to the international lending body. Washington has used it as a bargaining chip to force crisis-stricken Pakistan to allow US military bases in the country. Not going to the IMF would mean not allowing the global hegemonic powers to dictate policies.
Now, to have more insights, we are joined by Mr. Asim Khan, former PTI UK chapter president. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Khan. Now, Pakistan is one of the few countries most familiar with the International Monetary Fund, with a total of 22 programs in 70 years. So why does Pakistan keep going to the IMF?
Hello to everyone. I think one of the primary factors is that over the years in the past, as Pakistan has taken 20 bailout programs from IMF. What happened was all the previous governments, where the money should have been spent in terms of carrying structural reforms, institutional stability on initiatives and so on and so forth, that did not take place. And as a result of that, we kept going back to IMF every successive government. And when we took over in 2018, we did not want to go with IMF, but we had no choice left because the balance of payment crisis and all sorts of things were creeping up. And basically, we had inherited one of the worst and draconian balance of payment crisis that had been left by the previous government. And we only had, we literally had in the state bank $8 to $9 billion. So these were the things that, that actually made us revert back to IMF. Not that Pakistan actually wanted to go with IMF, but we had no choice left. And these were difficult decisions. So this is the reason and the background to why we have gone with IMF now, because of the previous government and what they've done.
Mr. Khan, there's a general belief that the IMF bailout packages can work as a short-term strategy but should be dumped in the long term. Now, what's your take on this?
I think absolutely. I agree with you that. I think any country would vouch for the fact that anyone who is borrowing money for any organizations of the world, be it the World Bank or the IMF, it may work out in the short term. And if, in, even for us in Pakistan, even that did not work in the short term as well. So let alone talking about the long term. So yes, I totally agree with the statement that IMF, taking borrowing money from IMF is never going to be a long-term solution. Long-term solution lies somewhere else. And that's where your strength, and that's what the government is trying to do, to actually invoke policies and initiatives that are long-term and that are for the welfare of the people of Pakistan. And for that, you need to have structural reforms. We need to actually have tax collection mechanism actually sorted out. We need to introduce digital transformation within our systems and institutions. So there are a number of things that are going on currently. Yes, it may seem difficult. It may seem that all sorts of noises are coming forward. But in the long run, it will bring all the benefits.
Mr. Khan, there are also concerns about structural reforms as demanded by the IMF, which many fear could curb growth and increase inflation. Now, do you think it puts the Imran Khan government in a difficult situation?
I think, as I said earlier on, that because of the fact that we had in 2018 when we took power from PMLN, the history was very bleak. The financial history of Pakistan, it was a mess. We were literally on the verge of being defaulted. The inflation had gone up. Our exports were literally not much. And the exports, what we were doing, were is the raw products. So now the focus is that we are going to be spending a lot of money in social sector as well. So we've launched one of the major programs to alleviate poverty as well, to bring the lower working class actually at a certain level, and to have those skills that will become the enabling factor for manufacturing as well, because you need three areas where the growth will come in. One being manufacturing, secondly the agriculture, third being the service industry, and to wrap it up, that's where the digital world and the IT technologies will play its part. And Pakistan has already started to see the effects of that dividend in IT industry and the products that are going out, the IT services that we are exporting out. Our exports are rising as well. But as I said earlier on, that because the dollar was fixed at such a price by the previous governments, and in particular the last government, that the imports, we were importing heavily, but we had nothing to export. And whatever we were exporting, it was not enough to actually balance out the BOP crisis.
Thank you, Mr. Khan. So glad to have you on the program. Now, let's see how people on social media see the situation.
Mir Muhammad Ali Khan, a Lahore-based investment banker, notes that Imran Khan government has won some great concession from IMF, which means the bill will be tabled in parliament for amendments. Social media activist Waqar Malik says Americans will use the IMF to retaliate against Pakistan for its growing ties with China, while hoping that Beijing will come to Pakistan's rescue. Senior Pakistan People's Party politician Sarafroz Rajar quotes party chief Bilawal Zardari as saying that as long as the IMF deal continues, the people of Pakistan will continue to suffer.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Recently, the news of an Afghan mother from northern Jozan province selling one of her newborn twins hogged headlines across the world. It brought to light two disturbing realities in present-day Afghanistan, the worsening U.S.-manufactured food crisis and children bearing the brunt of it. Hundreds of thousands of children across the crisis-stricken country face acute malnutrition, and most of them also face a harsh winter without proper shelter. This comes as the U.S. and its allies refuse to unfreeze Afghanistan's assets and facilitate the flow of humanitarian aid.
3 months since the U.S.-led international coalition beat a hasty retreat from Afghanistan and announced freeze on its assets, the country is teetering on the brink of a major humanitarian crisis. According to aid agencies and human rights watchdogs, children are the worst affected. The war-ravaged country that the U.S. and its allies occupied for 20 years is facing its worst hunger crisis ever seen. Save the Children has warned that more than half of the children under 5 may suffer from acute malnutrition amidst harsh winter. It also notes that 800,000 children in Afghanistan lack proper shelter or blankets amid sharp dip in temperature. UN officials report that more than 14 million children across the country face acute food insecurity. Many children have already starved to death amid severe food crisis, and many more are believed to be a step away from famine. UN and other international agencies have warned of more deaths this winter with worsening food insecurity and sheer apathy of the West. Reports of poor Afghan families selling their children for not affording their food bear testimony to the disastrous legacy of U.S.-led foreign powers in Afghanistan. The unfolding crisis, in particular the pitiful plight of children, should always weigh heavily on the American conscience.
One of the most defining but underreported characteristics of the U.S.-led military occupation of Afghanistan over the last two decades has been the harm caused to children. Thousands of children perished in America's carpet bombings, drone strikes, and night raids that went largely unnoticed. From Kunduz in the north to Khost in the south and Jalalabad in the east, U.S.-led forces unleashed a reign of terror, making no distinction between children and adults who were later conveniently forgotten by the world.
In a report released on August 31, Save the Children, the world's leading aid organization for children, said almost 33,000 children were killed and maimed in Afghanistan over the past 20 years, an average of one child every 5 hours. The figure did not include children who died due to hunger, poverty, and disease during that time. The real number of direct child casualties of the conflict, the aid organization said, is likely to be much higher. The report, drawing attention to the crisis triggered by the botched exit of Americans from Afghanistan in August, said nearly half of the population of Afghanistan, including nearly 10 million children, was in need of humanitarian assistance even before the recent turn of events unfolded. A total of 1,598 children suffered casualties during this time, it said, including 785 children killed and 813 injured. While these figures pertain to last 5 years alone, the U.S. perpetuated war crimes against children in Afghanistan began soon after Pentagon carpet bombed the country in October 2001, leaving trail of death and destruction. Thousands of children vanished in U.S. air raids, which toppled the Taliban.
Now, to have more insight, I'd like to welcome Mr. Mick Wallace to the program, a member of the European Parliament for Ireland South. Mr. Wallace, 3 months since the botched U.S. exit from Afghanistan and the freezing of assets, millions of children in the country face starvation and death. Now, do you hold the Biden administration responsible for it?
Yes, the Biden administration bears a lot of responsibility for the present situation, in the sense that things are really, really bad and they're not prepared to do the right thing. But obviously, the problems in Afghanistan go back many years. So, I mean, different American governments and different support from the European Union and NATO have obviously brought us to this terrible place. Last week, we had a very good discussion in the European Parliament. The ambassador for Iran in Belgium, in Brussels, his name is Ghulam Hossein Dayani. He came in and he answered questions to MEPs for over an hour and a half, and many of them were on Afghanistan. And I think a lot of the MEPs were a bit shocked that things are so bad, because we haven't really been hearing much in the media here for a while. The Afghan story has lost its attraction, and the media has moved on to other things, which is obviously terrible. But he pointed out that this winter, 23 million people in Afghanistan will be food insecure. He pointed out that 3 million children under the age of 5 are already suffering from severe malnutrition. Children are dying slowly, he said. And he said Iran is doing its best on the border, but is getting hampered by sanctions from the US and the EU, unfortunately. And this is absolutely criminal. There's already, before the Taliban took over in August, there was already 3.6 million Afghan refugees in Iran. And that's a UN figure. I heard a UN guy say that about 6 or 7 weeks ago in the parliament here. That's unbelievable. And yet, instead of helping Iran to deal with that, the Americans and the Europeans are refusing to help Iran deal with the problem. They're freezing money belongs to the Afghan government because they don't like the Taliban. Well, I tell you what, they can like a government or not like them, but it's the people they're persecuting right now. So the Biden administration is directly responsible for young people dying in Afghanistan today. That is 100% sure.
Mr. Wallace, there's been reports about a poor Afghan family selling their children amid the severe food crisis. Now, what should the international community do to force the U.S. to unfreeze Afghanistan's assets?
Well, listen, it's not rocket science. American administrations don't really care about people. They don't really care about their own. So it's probably a bit much expecting them to care about the people of Afghanistan. But what I would be saying to the European Union, who is a major partner of the U.S., I'd be saying to the European Union, who tells us every day how much they care about human rights, that it's about time that they actually show that they really care. And if they want to do that, they need to change their approach to Afghanistan right now, or is there's going to be terrible, terrible things happening there this winter. The EU, whether the US are up for it or not, but the EU has to unfreeze the money. The EU has to help more. It has to take on board that this is a humanitarian catastrophe that could be unprecedented. And we are sleepwalking. It's like it's almost as if we're waiting for things to get worse before we do anything about it. And I think it's paramount now, and there's a huge responsibility on the European Union to actually do something constructive to help the people and to start working with the Taliban government. They can hold their nose and not like the Taliban, but they've got to help the country of Afghanistan now. And remember, the problems today in Afghanistan didn't fall out of the sky. And unfortunately, the European Union propped up a corrupt Afghan government for many years. The European Union and its member states were involved in the NATO that were as much a part of the problem as the Americans, helping to destroy the place and destroy so many lives. We have a huge responsibility now to the people of Afghanistan.
Mr. Wallace, in a report in August, Save the Children said almost 33,000 children were killed or maimed in US and Afghan airstrikes over the past 20 years. So why is there no accountability for such war crimes?
Listen, where have you seen accountability anywhere? When have we ever had accountability? The winner makes up the rules. There's no international law in that area anymore. I mean, why didn't Clinton, George Bush, the two George Bushes, Obama, Trump, why didn't they ever face a criminal court? They all committed war crimes. Tony Blair committed war crimes in Iraq. He walks around a free man. Julian Assange is in prison for exposing the war crimes that many of these people were involved in. So the person who tells the truth and exposes them is in prison, and the people who committed the war crimes walk free. We have a big problem. International law has broken down, and it started with the Americans refusing to recognize it anymore. Israel refuses to recognize it. And sadly, more and more, I see the European Union engaging in illegal sanctions and coming up with their own rules-based order instead of recognizing the UN Charter and the international law that was formed after 1945.
Mr. Wallace, thank you for your precious time and knowledge. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Sana Said, a US-based journalist, says a million children in Afghanistan may possibly die this winter as the US-imposed freeze on Afghan assets remains in place. She calls it barbaric. Afghan-American activist and mental health therapist Nahid Fatahi refers to the killing of 10 Afghan civilians, including 7 children, in a U.S. drone strike in Kabul to highlight U.S. war crimes in her home country. Rashida Yousafzai, an Afghan-Australian journalist, says women are forced to sell their children in Afghanistan as famine threatens the lives of 1 million children.
And that was our episode about Pakistan's economic crisis and IMF's ineffective programs, and also children paying the heavy cost of America's military adventures in Afghanistan. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take care.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters, dear believers, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, wherever you are, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, and welcome to yet another edition from series of Q&A on Islamic beliefs from IRB English Radio. In this series of shows, we are trying to pose and answer some questions and doubts that comes towards to us on Islamic beliefs. The question that we are going to talk about today is about Salat or prayer. For that, we have invited a respected scholar from Qom Samir Schools, Sheikh Murtaza Karimi, to help us with the answers to the questions that we pose here. Before I pose the question, I'd like to welcome Sheikh Murtaza to the show and say salam to him. Sheikh, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
It's a great pleasure for us, Sheikh, to have you here, and many thanks for accepting the invitation. In this very show, we are trying to talk about a doubt or misconception which was posed and sent to us on the functionality of religion, specifically Islam. The question says that Islam is an old religion and it has been revealed and sent down by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to his prophet when? 14 centuries back. So it is going to be recommended for that time, not the time that we are in, not the time of technology. The time that people were using, let's say, horses and camels for their transports, and now we have airplanes and we have many different, better devices to use, whether for our transport or for communication, whatever we need in our today's life. So Islam was good for that time, but not for today, and it does not respond to all the needs and requests of a person in our today's life. What can be the answer for such doubt, Sheikhana? Are we really in problem in finding some solutions for the doubts or misconceptions, or in any case, for our problems in our today's life with Islamic teachings? But we see that we can find the answer for everything, not only in all the, let's say, hadith and narrations, but in the Quran itself. When we follow the Quranic rules, and they are actually looked as they have been set for our today, we see that it is still working. So what is the source of this doubt, and is this doubt really applicable to any kinds of life or, let's say, mentalities? I would be grateful if you let us know about the answer.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Of course, I mean, this question can be answered from different perspectives, and it needs a lot of time to explain all the Islamic laws and how they are relevant to our today's life. But to first of all, to answer this question, they claim that Islam is related to 14 centuries ago, and now with all today's technologies, it should not be followed anymore. I would like to give a couple of examples to ask this question, that why this is only mentioned about the religion of Islam and not about other philosophies, and why it is only mentioned about our Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family, and not about some other great people. The first example that I would like to mention is that the philosophy and ethics of Aristotle. We know that he lived many centuries before our Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family. But still today, his books are taught in, most prestigious universities of the world. And even in our time, which is known as the postmodernism, in some of the universities, even in the United States, they have come to this conclusion that we know we need to go back to the ethics as mentioned by Aristotle. And we have some, new schools supported by people like Charles Taylor and Michael Sandel. And they are preaching the ideas of Aristotle again. Now, the question is that why the theories of Aristotle can be applied today and not the teachings of Islam? What is the difference? So when it requires that they have a kind of prejudice against the religion of Islam. So it's not only a matter of time. If it is a matter of time, Aristotle lived many centuries before our prophet. So why you are continuing to study, his philosophy, his ethics, and so on and so forth. When it comes to some great poets, still we see that the poems of Hafez, the Iranian great poet, Rumi, Sa'di, they are studied not only by the Persian scholars, but by many Western scholars.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the difference? If one may argue that the value of the poets of poems of Hafez, Rumi, Sa'di belong to many centuries ago, and now we have all these technologies, we do not need them anymore. So no one will, pay attention to such argument. The same is true about, some Western poets like Goethe, for example. Still today, all his works are studied in the prestigious universities of the world.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
One may argue that Shakespeare's novel belonged to many centuries ago, and we need to put all of them aside. Why still, with all these technologies, we are continuing to study and read the novels of Shakespeare?
So whatever is old is not basically necessarily bad.
That's the point, that they just mentioned the fact that Islam belongs to 14 centuries ago, and now we have all these technologies.
Yeah.
So it's a fallacy. To prove this fallacy, I just mentioned these examples to say that for other people, you do not pay attention to the gap of time, like the gap of our time and the time of Aristotle.
Mm-hmm.
And also when it comes to especially some of the people who are supporters of so-called archaism, they try to bring about an alternative for the prophet.
Mm-hmm.
For example, some of them mention Cyrus or Kurosh, as it's pronounced in Persian language, or Zartosht. Now the question is that which one of them lived before the other, Cyrus or our prophet, peace be upon him, and his family? So when it comes to our prophet, they mention this gap of time. But when it comes to Cyrus, who lived many centuries before our prophet, they say that we need to follow his instructions. And not only that, we have the laws, which are famous as the Hammurabi's laws, nowadays are famous, although it belongs to so many centuries ago. But they refer to that, and no one argues that, they are for many centuries ago, and now we have all these technologies. Just let me give you another example. When it comes to the famous thinker of the East, and that is Confucius, when it comes to him, still today people are quoting his statements, and some people, they are following his instructions, or even Buddha. Many people are following his instructions when it comes to meditation. And no one mentions that, they lived many centuries ago, and today we have all these technologies.
Mm.
So my point, which is my first point, is that it seems that there is something, they have a problem with the religion of Islam and not with the teachings of Islam. Otherwise, what they mentioned can be applied to many other people, like, as I mentioned, Hammurabi, Aristotle, Cyrus, Confucius, Buddha, and so on and so forth. But no one is mentioning these arguments against these people and their teachings.
Very rational, thank you.
So this is the first one that I would like to mention. And the second point is that what is Islam all about? Islam I mean, mainly is about some beliefs, some ethical rules, and some, religious rules. Although we do not have time to,
definitely
explain all of them one by one,